Ocean Calls.
Hello and welcome to Ocean Calls, the podcast in which we plunge into the issues making waves on our blue planet. I'm your host, Euronews science reporter Jeremy Wilkes. In today's episode, we're talking about the green, slimy stuff you step over on the beach.
Oh, no, thanks.
The wonder food that will make you happy and healthy.
It's so subtle, you cannot really describe the taste.
It's pretty nice.
It's almost like a salad. Yeah, it's a salad.
And the answer to all kinds of environmental problems, from carbon sequestration to overfishing.
Which is pretty cool. I like it.
I'm talking about seaweed and whether you and I should be eating a lot more of it. Seaweed production in Europe is tiny compared to Asian producers. Europe farms a few thousand tons of seaweed per year compared to tens of millions of tons in Asia. But is European seaweed production and consumption poised for a breakthrough? Should we be eating more of it? To discuss this issue, I'm joined today by Simon Johansson, the CEO of Nordic Sea Farm, which is at the forefront of seaweed cultivation in the cold, nutrient-rich seas around Sweden. Hi, Simon.
Hello there. Happy to be here.
And Anna Siedler, a marine policy officer at Seas at Risk, an association of environmental organisations. Anna recently published a paper on how algae could be a sustainable alternative to current aquatic food systems. Hi, Anna.
Hi, Jeremy. Thanks for having me.
And at the end of our episode, you'll hear a lovely ocean tale from Austria's Eurovision singer César Sampson and his adventures in Portugal.
That floaty feeling and that smell and the sounds of the birds.
First, though, should we be eating more seaweed here in Europe? Let's get into the conversation. I come from South Wales, where we actually have a tradition of eating seaweed, where it kind of gets boiled up and turned into this something that's a little bit like tinned spinach. It's called lava bread. It's all right, but it's not enormously popular, to be absolutely honest. But do you eat seaweed a lot, and how do you eat it? Let's come to Simon first. I'm guessing the answer is yes.
The answer is yes, of course. You have to eat what you cultivate, right? If you know what to do with it, how to cook it, it can be really tasty and delicious. And depending on what kind of seaweed that you cook with, we grow sugar kelp and sea lettuce, and it was actually featured on the Nobel Prize dinner this winter. So you can do a lot with it, and the King of Sweden ate it, right? And he looked quite happy in the TV.
Yeah, I guess so. So breakfast, lunch and dinner then for you, is it?
Yeah, usually it's 2 out of 3 meals, I'd say, per day.
Really? Crikey me. Anna, let's hear from you.
Yes, I have to admit I don't eat seaweed that regularly, but I have to say during my research, I really got some taste for it and I really got interested. And I was also wondering why we don't eat more, because it's such a fascinating food source. And I mean, I get into contact a bit more when you travel to Asia or if you have sushi. That's, I think, the first starting point for many Europeans, yeah. But in Germany, it doesn't really have a culture so far.
Yeah.
So, I'm trying to my best to level this up a bit. But I'm interested to hear any recipes from Simon as well.
Yeah, because I've had it kind of pickled, right? And I think I had it in Asia, and that was rather nice. And Simon actually talked about pickled and having it with a glass of beer, which sounds marvellous. But what are the big sort of seaweed-eating countries in Europe? Is there anywhere where people really eat this stuff a lot?
I would say France is, one of the 4 leading countries in Europe, in Brittany, where they have harvested and grown seaweed for many, many years, I would say 50, 60 years, and it's really part of the local cuisine.
Mm.
In Europe, we actually eat more seaweed than we think. When we eat, for example, sushi, you have the green wakame salad, for example, you have the nori around the sushi. It's all seaweed, right? So many people eat more than they think they do, just that we don't maybe label it as a seaweed.
Is all seaweed edible? I've talked about stepping over on the beach, and certainly on the coast of Wales, you see it there a lot, and you don't really kind of think, let's eat some of that. But is all seaweed, Anna, is all of it basically edible?
No, it isn't. You have to look at the specific species, but there are many that are edible.
Simon, could you literally go and harvest some on the beach if you knew what you were looking for, a bit like picking mushrooms in the forest?
Yeah, I would say also even more in seaweed. At least in Sweden, all the seaweeds are edible, but it depends a little bit on country where it's grown and located. Not all seaweeds are, what do you say, farmable in that sense, where you can plant on ropes, which we do. But if you just dive down and cut some seaweed and take it up, I'd say the chances are that they are edible, but it's of course always good to look up what kind of seaweed it is and what you can do with it and how much you can eat of it.
When you created Nordic Sea Farm, what was the original idea? What was the motivation?
So Nordic Sea Farm is founded by marine biologists, and the idea was to really see the environmental effects of large-scale seaweed farming. The research showed that it's very positive effects, that it absorbs excess nutrients from the water and also promotes local biodiversity. It creates life for small fishes and habitats for other organisms, which is very positive because, unfortunately, we see otherwise the opposite happening in our coastal areas, at least around Sweden and Northern Europe.
And can you describe what it actually looks like?
So a seaweed farm is just one long rope, about 100 meters, which is connected with anchors and some buoys that lies about 1 meter below the surface. So that is, in practice, a seaweed farm, just one long line of rope. And then you can just add more ropes. And right now, we farm from on about 8 hectares, which is maybe 4 soccer fields or so in the ocean.
Anna, why aren't there farms like this everywhere, where there's a spare bit of space on the sea? Because it sounds like it's pretty easy. You can probably build a business around it.
Yes, I mean, that's really the benefit of these things, that you have a low kind of entrance level for this when it comes to cost, when it comes to knowledge. Also very good when you think about the transition that is needed towards more low impact, small scale fisheries. It's a good question of the why. I mean, we often envision the sea as a space that is, you know, endless, infinite, but that's not the case. In Europe, actually, we are quite packed. We have a number of different players there in the field when it comes to offshore wind, to gas extraction, oil drilling, shipping, fishing. There are so many users, so it's not as easy to say, oh, there's so much space, let's do it. You want to ideally keep these farms close to the coast. You have a lot more nutrient import there that these algae farms and seaweed farms can use. As closer as you are to the coast, it's easier for the farmers to harvest all these things. While when you go a bit more offshore, of course, you need a boat, you need to get there, you need to do the maintenance work.
Did you know that seaweed is not a plant and doesn't have roots and flowers? It's a type of algae, and it grows from nutrients in the water, creating energy from photosynthesis. To survive and grow, it normally attaches itself to something in the water.
It does sound like utterly marvellous stuff, and I absolutely loved reading about seaweed, getting ready for this episode. Just talk us through a little bit, Anna, maybe some of the things you can do with seaweed in terms of eating it, for example, kind of how it's prepared, what's being done, what can it replace? Because I've seen things that look an awful lot like tuna that are actually made out of seaweed. I've seen things that look a lot like smoked salmon that are made out of seaweed, etc. What can we do with it?
I really love seaweed salad, to be honest. I think that's the most baseline easy thing. It tastes great, especially if you are into this kind of a bit marine, fishy, salty taste. I mean, this is the perfect way to replace seafood products or like fish or salmon or whatever you have. But there's also a lot of growing interest in these kind of alternatives, plant-based meat and fish alternatives. They are growing quite quickly, and I'm really amazed how they can really get to a similar taste of, for example, seafood and salmon and fish. And I mean, there's also, next to macroalgae, there's also microalgae, but both you can put into powder form and you can basically do anything with it at the end and have great nutritional values from it.
I was going to say, nutrition-wise, what's in it? Is it full of protein?
It depends on the species. There are 3 groups of seaweed. It's brown seaweed, it's green seaweed, and red seaweeds. The brown ones are the big ones that you can see also in the ocean. They're quite big in carbohydrates and fiber. and usually a good source also for flavor, packed with umami, used a lot in ramen dishes and so on. Not that high in protein, it's maybe 10%, so like pasta or so. But the green seaweeds, we grow sea lettuce, for example, that's quite high in protein. It's 30% in dry matter. That was the one that was used also on the Nobel Prize dinner. It's a bit milder in taste, so it can be used in a bit broader application areas. And we have the red seaweeds, typically also quite high in proteins, at least the ones that we farm in Europe, like dulse. It's also called the ocean's bacon because it gives away a smoky flavor when you fry it. Whoa. Which is quite interesting. But it also depends. But I think a big market also to mention that is also the alginate market, which is seaweed that you typically not farm, but you just harvest wild. And it goes into alginates such as thickening, emulsifiers, mainly for food, but also for what's squishy. That usually comes from alginates from brown seaweeds.
Anna?
Yeah, algae has, Simon said, vitamin C, K, you have iodine, you have iron in some species. But I think the main factor that is really interesting, especially if we look at European consumption behaviors, is omega-3. I think there is a lot of hype around eating seafood products to get your omega-3 level up because it's supposed to be good for your eyes, for your brain. It's very much recommended also by governments. And while a lot of people don't really know about it, I guess, that omega-3 is not built by the fish themselves, but they get the omega-3 by eating algae. So in the worst case, you have a scenario where you have algae that is eaten then by a wild fish, basically, that often is caught, often in a very destructive way by bottom trawling, for example, releasing a lot of carbon into the atmosphere, which is then, and this is really ironically, fed to another fish, which is the aquaculture fish. So we have a lot of wild caught fish that just gets into feeding to aquaculture fish that then we eat to get our omega-3. So for me, it's a no-brainer to say, okay, if we can skip all these impact lines, and it's not only environmental impact, it also has a lot of social impacts when it comes to injustice, human trafficking, and so on. And if we are going for the nutritional value, why don't we just eat the algae directly, right?
Did you know that 70% of the world's oxygen comes from seaweed and algae? It also takes carbon out of the atmosphere in the same way as trees.
Let's move on to the EU, the policy and support, the framework that you've got as a farmer, actually, Simon. I'm interested in that because I get a very strong impression that the European Commission and elsewhere in Brussels, they would really like to see that seaweed economy grow in Europe. There's investment going in there, there's research going into it, there are conferences that happen. Are you, as a seaweed farmer, getting the support that you need, the kind of legal frameworks, etc., and investments to actually grow?
I think it's really been building up the last couple of years. And I think in 2022, they launched an initiative for algae with 20 identified critical points, how we really can support the European blue bioeconomy, where seaweed is a large part. Thus saying, it's still a new area, and I think they're still navigating what can really benefit farmers. Is it permits out there? Is it processing facilities and connection to networks? And also the general, adoption of seaweed market-wise. Mm. But so far, I think we'll be getting good support, but obviously we'd like to see even more bets on the investment side, because it is a big... when you're going to go and scale up, especially compared to Asian producers. And if we are to compete with those, then we need to build up that infrastructure, both in the ocean and also on land.
Where would you say you most need support now?
Right now, I would say it's actually in the middle segment. I think we cracked the code, both in the lab R&D work, which Nordic Sea Farm has worked with a long time ago. And also, we have more companies in Europe that has done that. The farming side and upscaling is on its way. But bottleneck is also the processing, how you can process it into value-adding applications. If you take land, for example, you can take pea protein, for example, and how you can just extract the protein from that. I believe we need to do the same with seaweed to make it even more applicable into as an ingredient into various food sources.
What would be the kinds of incentives that would improve that situation then? Do you think at the end of the day it's a market pull that's going to change that?
I think a market pull is always needed. I think you cannot just push anything out and believe that the customer will be ready to buy. So we spend quite a lot of time working with larger corporates. But it's also a bit of a dilemma because you also have to be big enough to be able to deliver to the large corporations and customers, right? So I think we need to go from both ways, kind of incentivize large-scale farming so we can be competitive in price and quality, and also to work even closer to these actors to do maybe smaller-scale pilots and work with small and medium-sized customer first, which is our focus right now.
Anna, the EU just added 20 algae species to its EU novel food status catalogue in February that happened. Is that kind of thing significant? It basically means that some new species can be sold, I think.
Yes, definitely. I mean, I think that's a really good step into the right direction, and it shows that the EU is really willing to do something. And I think it's a win on both sides, producers and consumers, because you can diversify the field a bit more as soon as you have more species. But also with that novel food regulation in place, it makes it, and adding this species, it makes it a lot easier, because previously you had to do a pre-market authorization for every new kind of species you want to have. And now adding these species, I think, kind of gets a bit of a shortcut. But of course, it's not enough. And the EU has to get into some speed. The regulatory framework is very fragmented at the moment. There are so many regulations involved if you want to do seaweed farming. It's not really included in current national maritime spatial plans. So there are a lot of hurdles. And I think, as Simon says, also the infrastructure is not really there yet. So we need some incentives from the market side, of course, as well. But I think we also, and the EU Commission is working on that, we need kind of a bit of a guidance, taking farmers a bit more by the hand and say, you can do this, and we are there, and there are incentives, and it's a good thing.
If you want to get into this business, is it a good time, actually?
Yeah, I would say so. I think it's really getting more and more traction every year. I think not just being biased and looking at the seaweed news, I do see it's being out there more and more products are being created. And as Anne said, I think more brands are also requesting seaweed, especially in the plant-based sector. And they
How do you kind of differentiate your product, though, to the mass-produced stuff that, as you said, it's coming at a lower price from China or Indonesia? How do you differentiate your product?
It also depends on the brands you work with. We started off in the food service sector, working a lot with restaurants and hotel chains, where they really want to highlight that it's grown locally. It comes from Sweden or Europe, etc. You can tell a story when it comes to, for example, a plant-based tuna, a plant-based salmon. Biomaterials is one actually really exciting area. And I think we will see a lot more of that. And they all need responsible sourcing, right? And that is something that we will see much, much more in the value chain coming forward.
Anna?
Yes, you can do so many things with seaweed, like pharmaceuticals or biofuel or whatever. I think at the end, I mean, you have to have a look what really makes sense. I mean, this is a really treasurable resource that you have there. And ideally, you want to use it for food, to really feed people, to tackle some of the global issues we have, to tackle some of the issues we have with our current very malfunctioning seafood system of wild caught and aquaculture. There is, especially in the recent years, there was a lot of interest in biofuel. I have the feeling it's gone down a bit. And I have to say, I'm glad about it, because if you take a closer look at these kind of things with biofuels, for example, you see that it kind of has the same problems as biofuel from land crop. It's not really efficient. You have a lot more energy intake than you get out.
But the kind of replacement into plastics, perhaps, it could be of interest. I mean, Simon was talking about films that, you know, that when there's so much packaging out there that you see in the supermarket, that has to be replaced by something sustainable eventually. Could seaweed be the solution?
I mean, I don't see seaweed, overall speaking, as the silver bullet for anything. I think it can replace some parts of the destructive system that we have. Of course, it's much nicer if you have seaweed plastic that decomposes than, you know, real plastic than that is in the ocean for years. But on the other hand, it doesn't really tackle the root causes. And that is really our consumption behavior. But instead, it gives a bit of the incentive to consume even more. Mm. So for me, it's a question, do I have then a seaweed packaging out of, you know, seaweed plastic, or do I just bring my own back every time and, you know, change my consumption behavior?
That's a big shift, though, isn't it? Getting to the point where the consumer has their sort of seaweed bag with them ready to go and pick up their seaweed. Good luck getting that one to happen. I mean, I'm not saying it's not going to happen, but it's not going to happen next week. I suppose some of the bottlenecks we were talking about, but bottlenecks are to do with a general adoption of this product as a kind of an acceptable product that you can be doing things with. And that, behind that, is even awareness of it as a product. But Simon, do you meet a lot of people who just look at you blankly when you say you're a seaweed farmer?
I think some are more, well-read and really into it than you anticipate. And I would say 98% are super positive when we speak about it. And some people is like, wow, seaweed, that's something else when you swim in the ocean, right? But we receive a lot of positive feedback, both from local communities when we tell what we do, but also when you are out there with the product innovators and they see that we need to make the shift. I think plastic is already on the way out the door. Mm. Wood-based products is also under threat because we use too much of it, right? Right now also with the e-commerce and so on. Yeah. So I think seaweed would really, it really needs to happen, but it also needs a good product innovation because the function needs to be there, right?
Do you think it fundamentally needs rebranding somehow? That actually at the end of the day, this is possibly about marketing.
I think actually it does. Maybe it's not so much about a makeover completely, but I think it's a lot about awareness raising. But on the other hand, I think it's also a problem that people don't yet understand why do we even have to do a transition from a system that is not working to somewhere else. I think here lies a bit the problem that many people just don't know how impactful their seafood consumption is, not only on the environment, but also when it comes to terms that Europe is really right now eating away food from other countries that depend on it.
That's an interesting transition, and that argument is difficult to make. You need to be upfront with people about the overconsumption, about the stresses on the ecosystems, and to say, look, this is a possible alternative. You know, what are the things you'd like to see, Anna, to get us to the point where seaweed is kind of automatically seen as a choice on the menu?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it's as always, a systemic transition. There will be more farmers now who will get into that seaweed farming game. I think then a lot of more marketing and awareness raising will also come from these companies. What I wish to see is that we transform it to a new system that is also ideally really stays low impact and is small scale and really contributes to coastal communities and livelihoods of people, rather than recreating a system that we already have where big corporations come into play, where we have, a political economy that is very centralized and becomes probably a big player in the food system, like we can see it now with seafood, but also agricultural problems that we have. So for me, ideally, in an utopia, we create a system that really stays small scale and low impact and decentralized with local value chains and really appreciating this as a food and appreciating it as a great source for nutrition that can really feed people without having a lot of the impacts that we have currently with our system.
Yeah. Simon, how do you see the development? It's interesting, the warning, I suppose, we have there from Anna about becoming too big, but on the level we want it to grow.
Yeah, so I think both are needed in that sense, that you both need small-scale farmers that can supply maybe to a more central unit. That's one thing that you do in the US. Thus, you also get more scale economics. If you have a large farm with a larger vessel, you can farm more at once and so on and get a better price. So I think both will be needed, and I think both are part of our model to farm to a certain extent large-scale and offshore, but also to source in from local farmers to really enable living coastal communities, because we're a strong believer in that.
May I ask a question to Simon, maybe?
Go on.
I would be very interested to hear how you farm specifically, because one of the problems really, I think, and that's one of the issues where we might tap into the same mistakes as been happening already in Asia or also on the land side, is about monocultures. And I think in my dream system, we also have a bit of marine permaculture. We avoid having so much disease spread. We combine it with different other uses of the sea, like wind farms, but also mussel farming, for example. Is this kind of something you are approaching?
Yes, we're actually doing both. So one, we're collaborating with offshore wind farm at OX2 outside of Varberg in Sweden. So they have 1,000 hectare license, and they also want to utilize co-creation in their wind parks. That's going to be deployed in 2027, 2028, which we're very excited about. But also these kind of IMTA solutions with mussels and oysters. And the fun part is that they can actually help each other by sending out not excess nutrients, but they actually have some kind of biological defense. It's what I've been told, that it's increased when you farm them together. And we believe that it will be even better to both avoid monoculture and just doing more of one thing then.
My thanks to Simon Johansson from Nordic Sea Farm and Anna Siedler from Seas at Risk for opening our eyes to the world of seaweed as seafood. And now to the part of the podcast in which a well-known person tells us all about a standout moment at sea. Our guest this time is Austrian singer Cesar Samson.
3, 2, 1.
He tells the tale of sneaking off for a sailing trip during the Eurovision Song Contest.
Hello, my name is Cesar Samson. I'm a professional musician, among other things. I'm known to the people of Europe for my third place finish and jury win at Eurovision 2018 in Portugal, my favorite country from now on. I had Eurovision in Portugal, which is a harbor city. And since I had been a bit more experienced in things Eurovision, I knew that it's really sometimes hard to get a day off or a time off and to unwind. There's a lot of first timers there that are just wired into the whole Eurovision craziness and they don't really get to enjoy the whole experience. And since I knew better than that, I invited some of my contestants, some of my enemies, other countries, to go on a sailing trip with me. So we weren't sailing for a whole day. We didn't tell our delegations. We just took off and went on a sailing boat and just vanished for a day. And we were out in the ocean, basically. And yeah, it really put me in touch with my natural identity as an artist.
Inhale, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Because the other things that surround you there is a lot of interviews, a lot of media, a lot of opinions. And and I use nature to anchor me in myself.
Exhale.
I invited the countries that were around me at the time. I could have invited anyone because it's a really big family. I was in great contact with most of the other countries, but I went with Macedonia and Switzerland. Yeah, it was just a spur of the moment thing. Yeah, we just enjoyed ourselves. It was not a highly intellectual affair. It was just forgetting everything and just gliding. Because I will stress again, this is a highly stressful time in terms of feeling judged. Like, there's a lot of opinions on you about, and there's like betting on you.
$400 million is the bid.
Will you fare well? How high are you going to finish? Are you going to wash out in the semifinals? So there's people like putting in money on you to win and stuff like that.
And the piece is sold.
So there was a lot to get away from, and the ocean just offered that to us at that day. I felt like I had everything that I need to succeed. This is what nature does for me, especially when it's not regulated. But the ocean is untamable. The ocean is just the ocean. There's no taming the ocean. So this is probably the space that gives that to me, that reconnection with my true life's purpose and with my passions, and washes all the periphery away. And I just love the smell. Like, it's a mix between like that floaty feeling and that smell and the sounds of the birds, like audio sensoric experience is what I take away from it. And like I said, I couldn't tell you the color that the ocean had at that day. I know it was beautiful, but for me I could get the smell and the sound from it still to this day.
Well, thanks to Cesar for that great behind-the-scenes story. You've been listening to Ocean Calls, a bi-monthly podcast for Friends of the Sea, in which we break down science and share interesting ocean facts. If you like this episode and want to learn more, go to the Euronews YouTube channel and listen to a longer version of this conversation. To know more about our guests and their work, check the links in the description. I'm your host, Jeremy Wilkes, and this show is produced by Naira Dablashian and Natalia Olsner. The sound editing is by Jean-Christophe Marco, and sound mixing is by Mathieu Duchesne. Our editor-in-chief is Sophie Claudet. Ocean Calls is produced in partnership with the European Commission's Directorate General for Maritime Affairs and Fisheries.